Welcome to another episode of the CSIS podcast. I'm Colm Quinn. Now, usually we do this week's news in foreign policy, but the events of last week have had such a big impact that they remain the focus for this week's show. By now, the details of the attacks on Paris are well known. 8 men with allegiances to the Islamic State used bombs and machine guns to terrorize the city, leading to the deaths of 130 people. The carnage wrought by ISIS seems to be on the increase. The Russian airliner exploded over Sinai after a bomb was placed on board, and Beirut's dual suicide bombings the day before the Paris attacks have also been claimed as ISIS acts. And now that it seems that the fight has gone global, how can they be stopped? A lot of the talk from political leaders on both sides of the Atlantic has centered around how better intelligence could have stopped this attack. So what could have been done better? Is encrypted communications to blame? And are Europe's intelligence services sufficiently equipped to take on a threat of this scale? I sat down with intelligence expert and the director of our strategic technologies program, Jim Lewis, to see how far the West's intelligence services have come since 9/11 and what they can do to thwart further attacks. We begin by discussing whether these attacks in Paris were a result of a large-scale intelligence failure.
If somebody stands outside your house and throws rocks every day for a week, eventually one of them's going to get through. And that's what we're seeing here. It's not an intelligence failure. You could look at the fabric of laws and border controls and intelligence cooperation that the Europeans have put together in the last 20 years and say it was inadequate. So Schengen Agreement, it's really beneficial. It's a good thing. It's part of being a big country. But it meant that people could drive from Brussels to Paris without, or through Germany en route to Paris without necessarily being stopped. So it's not an intelligence failure, per se. It's that Europe and its laws were designed for a different and safer world.
Well, let's try and compare it to America. I mean, you can drive from California to Nevada without getting stopped too, but because of the way that the intelligence system is set up, it doesn't change how that person is tracked. Well, how does it work that someone can go from Belgium to France, be under the Belgian intelligence authority there, and then move to being under France? Who's in charge then? How does that information sharing work? Does it even happen?
The U.S. has three advantages. First, we're not geographically connected. We're far away. You can't get from Syria to the U.S. By land, by foot, by car, by train. That's a real problem. Second, we've done better at integrating Muslim immigrants, and that means that the kind of ghettos you see in Europe, where you have this unhappiness in suburbs filled with the banlieues of Paris or parts of Brussels, we don't have that thing, and so that's an advantage. And the third one is the Europeans really don't have a federal system. Schengen is like the U.S. in that you can drive from state to state, but we have a federal system that means there's one single authority that is going to be trying to monitor this kind of terrorism, and that would be FBI assisted by NSA. And in Europe, of course, you have this handoff problem. So the Belgians might be monitoring to the extent of their capabilities, which are limited, and then you have to figure out how do you hand it off to the French. The British might know something they have to. So the incomplete federalism of Europe explains a lot of what happened here.
And I know I keep bringing it back to America, but it's the only real point of Western reference for something like this. And, you know, one of the criticisms post 9/11 in the United States was that there was a lot of intelligence agencies that knew things in the States, but not necessarily talking to each other. And one of the big challenges post 9/11 was trying to make them better integrated. Is there something Europe could learn from that, or has the U.S. been successful in integrating the way its information shared?
No, when you think about things like the National Counterterrorism Center, which has been pretty successful, when you think about the fact that you have FBI, which operates across the continent and has made counterterrorism a focus. When you think about the surveillance programs that were put in place after 9/11 for metadata and communications, all of these things create a package that gives the U.S. an advantage. And perhaps the Europeans could look at some way to centralize counterterrorism activities, but it's very difficult for them because unlike the states, these are sovereign nations with independent agencies, and it's difficult to get cooperation up and running. The European Union is not a good vehicle for security cooperation because that's not part of its competence. And so they have, for example, an intelligence office in the European Union, but its main activity seems to be avoiding being squashed by the great powers, right? There's a unwillingness to let the EU, let the Commission, take a leading role in security matters. And that kind of ambivalence complicates the ability of the Europeans to create the same kind of structure we have here. But they're useful lessons they could draw.
And one of the criticisms, I suppose, the U.S. has had of Europe as of late is defense spending and the idea that the U.S., you know, Europe's kind of being a free rider in a lot of ways and that the U.S. is picking up the slack. Are we seeing the same lack of investment in the intelligence services that even if they could track and even if they are getting tipped off, that they simply don't have the manpower to be able to keep track of all these people?
No, unlike defense spending, unlike spending on the military, the Europeans have been pretty good at spending on their security services because they know they face a real threat. They know they have people who are out to do harm. So I don't think it's a problem of a lack of willingness to spend, as opposed to defense, where they're notorious for cutting. You know, look at the Brits and what they're doing on defense spending. They're demilitarizing, but they have not demilitarized when it comes to domestic intelligence, domestic security.
And I want to change subject a little bit to talk about the Paris attacks themselves and how it is that someone who is flagged perhaps as a threat can go to Syria, return to the country and launch an attack. Explain to us how that process works now, whether there is a process right now that if someone is going to Syria that they get flagged, or if someone is deemed to be a threat, at what level does it start that the surveillance is kicking in or that there's some sort of action by security services to preempt that threat?
One of the problems we have in this discussion is that there's a perception endorsed by some in the media and some in the entertainment world of a kind of Big Brother environment where the government tracks everything and knows everything. That's not how it works in real life. The Europeans spend on their security services, but they don't have enough resources to cover everyone, particularly when you're talking about thousands of potential recruits. And hundreds, if not thousands, of people going to Syria, being radicalized, learning skills. So they just don't have the manpower to cover this kind of thing because there are too many. And one of the problems that is the most difficult is that the traditional solution to this kind of domestic insurgent threat involves some restrictions on civil liberties, perhaps on movement, perhaps changing the rules for arrest and detention. Right now, if you look at most of the attacks in France, all or almost all of the attackers were known to the security services. In some cases, or in many cases, they had been detained. But after a few days, they had to be released. And so this catch-and-release policy creates an opportunity for terrorists, the ability to evade detection, go to Syria, come back, that creates an opportunity for terrorists. But these are very difficult questions, and no one looks willingly on these sorts of restrictions. The French may be driven to it if there is another round of attacks. They are already considering some of these. But one of the things we've known since 9/11 is that the jihadist groups will exploit the loopholes in Western law. And so they know and will discuss the protections that are provided that are essential for civil liberties, but they'll think about how to use them to carry out their attacks. This is a difficult political problem for us, and we may not have an answer.
It seems, though, that post 9/11, the U.S. has had some success in deterring attacks. Now, you can't say that it's had 100% success, but some of it has been in, you see these lone wolf attackers that have been I wouldn't say entrapped, but certainly enticed to give away the game by the FBI and by others. Is that something Europe can do? Is that something that they have the ability to do, even from a legal perspective?
The scale of the threat is much greater in Europe. So where we might be dealing with dozens of potential attackers, the Brits are dealing with hundreds of potential attackers. And the continental Europeans are probably dealing with thousands of potential attackers. So you need a different kind of strategy there. All the things that we've talked about, all the reasons that a truly federal system has an advantage, work in the favor of the U.S. But the thing that probably is the most important is that we are not geographically connected. It's much harder to bop back and forth between Syria and your homeland than it is, say, in Belgium or in France.
Let's talk about this information war that is being waged right now, both in propaganda terms and also in just pure communication terms, pure person-to-person communication. What's the current state of play there? Can we say that we're winning, that we're able to track these guys, or is it a case where they're managing to evade?
Well, there's two sets of problems there. One, you really, if possible, want to avoid governments deciding what is legitimate speech and what isn't. So in the U.S., if you don't directly advocate violence, it's permissible. And that's probably, in the long term, the right answer, right? So I don't think we can shut down Twitter. We can't shut down social networks. There's always this question of, do you shut people down or do you use them to gather intelligence? And frankly, I think the benefits from intelligence gathering outweigh any benefit you would get from shutting things down, because people identify themselves, people communicate about potential plans. About a third of traffic among jihad groups is encrypted, but that means two-thirds isn't. You know, plus the metadata on a message, you know, the address, the number, that's not encrypted. So the ability to identify attackers that we get from allowing them to use these platforms is great. It's a dual-edged sword for them. It gives them global communications capabilities, but they know it also makes them vulnerable to Western intelligence services. And I think the benefit is such that we should continue to do that. The problem, getting back to our earlier discussion, is once you identify people, what do you do with them, particularly when you don't have the resources to monitor them all?
Well, it seems crazy to me that, say, that the Islamic State have this English language magazine, Dabiq, that they put out. They've put out a number of issues at this point. And it just seems like such a mundane thing that they're able to do right out in the open, that with all the powers that world governments have in cyber warfare and in tracking these people, that a simple thing like that, just to take an example, could be shut down. But I guess if they want to track it, they want to keep that open.
The answer to information is not to try and block it. The answer is more information and better information. And the fact that there are people who find ISIS appealing is troubling. It says something about the integration of immigrants into Western European society. There's a deeper problem, right, which is that we've created a very powerful model for narratives in the West that focuses on oppression. And so you're oppressed and you then engage in struggle to liberate yourself. And this goes back to the colonial movements, anti-colonial movements of the 1950s. But it's a narrative you can see played in the liberation movements in South America. And now you see the jihadi saying it, the architect of the Paris attack said he had for his entire life seen the blood of Muslims shed, and now he was going to take action against those who were shedding it. Well, that's complete nonsense. But this powerful concept we have of oppression and liberation, we really need to take a step back and think about that. These people aren't oppressed. In Europe, they're not, right? And how do you dismantle this myth? How do you start cutting away at that? And that'll be hard for us because it's become woven into the fabric of our culture.
Well, I suppose it's back to what you said about the difference between, you know, being a Muslim in America versus being a Muslim in Europe. Not say it's perfect, but it's certainly different to the European experience.
Yeah, I think, we don't want to be too critical of the Europeans, but unlike the U.S., many countries in Europe, with perhaps the exception, a few exceptions, are ethnically homogenous. And we're not ethnically homogenous. So, it's like one more group, the line forms to the left, who cares? And in Europe, where everyone might be families that have lived in the country for centuries, it's different. So a hard struggle for them with the migrants they have, with the Syrian refugees. And it does probably contribute a little bit to jihad. We don't want to pat ourselves too much on the back, though. We face the same risks, perhaps not to the same degree, but we face the same risks as the European. And the next attack could just as easily be in New York or Los Angeles as in Paris.
Let's talk about the encryption debate a little bit. We did mention earlier that about 2/3 is unencrypted, but that 1/3 obviously is still a large amount. How big of a problem is that?
The people who are responsible for public safety are deeply worried about encryption. I'm a little more relaxed, and you can see incidents in the past where there have been new technologies have created challenges for collection, and we've overcome them. One of the dilemmas here is what the intelligence agencies can do, particularly GCHQ or NSA, is not what FBI can do or not what local coppers can do. So what might be not much of a challenge for the high-end intel folks can be a big challenge for law enforcement. Secondly, even if NSA collects it, it may not be usable in court, right? So that's a problem for and NSA has, contrary to popular belief, limited resources, so they're not going to be helping with the kind of criminal cases you might see challenging local law enforcement. That said, one good data point is that there were about 75 cases last year in New York where encryption posed problems for prosecutors. That's out of 100,000 total cases. So it's a relatively small percentage. And if only 1/3 of jihadi traffic is encrypted, that means 2/3 isn't. So the numbers suggest this isn't a big problem right now. There are ways to beat encryption. It's safe to assume that you're not going to get perfect encryption if you do it yourself. What worries law enforcement is if big tech giants like Apple start offering end-to-end encryption that's unbreakable or is allegedly unbreakable. You can probably think of ways to get around it, but they may not be legal, right? And that's what they're worried about, is they're going to face situations where they will not be able to read the traffic. Other companies, it's not so much of a problem. Most companies want recoverable encryption. And so one of the problems we've had in this debate is that the privacy advocates have, as they always do, mischaracterized it as the government wanting backdoors into your traffic. It's not a backdoor issue. First of all, if a big intelligence agency wants a backdoor, they're going to get it and they're not going to ask your permission. Second, what law enforcement wants is recoverable encryption. They want to be able to serve a warrant and recover the plain text of the message. And in most cases, they can do that. Big companies don't want to use unrecoverable encryption. They face liability risk. They don't want their employees doing something funky. They want to protect their IP. So most of the encryption used in the world is recoverable. Companies like Google use recoverable encryption because they want to read your plain text so they can do advertising, right? They data mine your traffic. So we're talking about a small set of cases where there could be risk. And the fear is that risk will grow, or that you'll see things like attacks like Paris that were the result of the use of encryption. It's important to note that the attackers in Paris did not use encryption. It looks like they just used text messaging. Now, that said, the Global Islamic Media Front, which has a technical arm that supports ISIS, They offer a package to encrypt text messages, to encrypt SMS. So it is sort of a race. The law enforcement guys are right to be concerned, but we don't want to overstate the problem.
And finally, just to wrap it up, ministers and leaders of all types in Europe, especially in France and Belgium right now, are meeting to try and figure out what to do, try to figure out how to improve their intelligence and how to improve how they track people so something like Paris doesn't happen again. What would you recommend to those people now?
This is a political problem and a legal problem. So they need to think about the standards for detaining people and the standards for holding them. I don't think surveillance is a problem in Europe because it's kind of funny. On one of the jihad websites, it says you're better off using American services because there's more restrictions on surveillance in America. If you go outside, there's fewer restrictions. So it's not really a surveillance problem in Europe. It might be resources. It might be cooperation among agencies, which is largely informal now, but relatively strong, but perhaps formal cooperation would be better. And then finally, they have this very difficult question of identifying someone as a potential attacker. What actions should you take? And that's a political decision that societies have to be comfortable with. To give you examples that you might want to look at, you could look at what the British did in Malaya in the 1950s, and you could look at what France did in Algeria. Also in the 1950s and 60s. These aren't happy examples, but if this is indeed a risk we're facing, they're examples that have to be looked at. So that's what I'd say to them is think about how you cooperate, think about what your rules are, and think about if you want to spend a little bit more on your services.
And just one more follow-up. Since 9/11, have World Intelligence Services, have they drastically improved? Have they gotten any better? I mean, Al-Qaeda, the guys who are flying the planes, you know, communicating with, you know, draft emails that they all have the password to and they all have the username, but they don't actually send anything. And we're, I guess, a little smarter to that now. How much of an improvement has there been in the last, say, 14 years?
One thing that's impressive to me is the attention that groups like ISIS and Hezbollah now pay to communication security. They know they're being tracked. They know that the Western services have pretty strong capabilities, and they are pretty good at looking for ways to defeat it. The advantage is probably a little bit still with the West, but it's a dynamic situation. They come up with a technique. It takes a while to beat it. I don't know if we could go and say that it's the ability to provide for secure communications that has led to any particular attack, but there's no doubt it improves their efficiency, and there's no doubt that it increases risk for us. So hopefully we'll be able to stay abreast of them. Hopefully we'll be able to stay ahead. That's part of the concern over tech giants providing commercial services to groups that might take advantage of them for the wrong purposes. But so far, a little bit in our favor. It's worth looking, though, that if you have that this is a long-term fight, and signals intelligence gives you a little bit of an edge in that fight, but it doesn't guarantee victory. It doesn't guarantee there won't be attacks. At a general level, the nature of intelligence activities has changed since 9/11, and now the thing that's most likely to guarantee success is the ability to combine different sources of intelligence. So don't think of this just as an encryption fight. It's blending SIGINT, traditional telecom, cyber espionage, and human agents. It's that blend of intelligence that gives you the ability to prevent, to deter, to block attacks. And that's probably the biggest change, partially out of the lessons of 9/11, is you need to be able to combine your intelligence sources to make it work. And the Brits, the French, in particular, a few other European countries are good at this. But we don't want to think of this just as an encryption battle or an internet battle. It's an intelligence battle, and you need to bring all the resources to bear.
And that was Jim Lewis bringing us to the end of this week's show. If you want more analysis on the conflict in Syria and its widening impact on the world, you can head to csis.org. I'm Colm Quinn. Thanks for listening.